This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
People think that this operator is all la-di-da. Sometimes I used to think it myself. You do get some people with la-di-da accents, but you don't hear many people going around with those accents today.
Dr. Baker phoned me in the morning, left a note, he's still yawning. Dr. Baker phoned me in the morning, left a note.
Whether or not you agree with the concept of social class, this particular program in the series Music is Good for You looks at the connection between social class and musical preference. Paraphrasing this glibly, we could say, which is it for you, Beethoven or Britney? This program is simply a sociological exploration of music taste, cultural consumption and social class. Another way of looking at this question would be by asking the question, does music taste affirm one's social class? In other words, can we identify a difference in music tastes and music consumption between people from different social classes, assuming that we all agree there is such a thing as social class? And if there is different types of music for different social classes, why is this? We don't pretend to give a comprehensive scientific answer to this, but the least we can do is explore and discuss the theme.
We've all been hurt by love, it's out of our hands. But for what it's worth, I'm drawing a line in the sand.
The first person I spoke to about the topic of music and social class was the titular organist of Dublin's Pro-Cathedral and Professor Emeritus of Music at NUI Maynooth, Gerard Gillan. Gerard Gillan was born and grew up in Inchicore and was introduced to music in general by a next-door neighbour called John Cleary, who was then the organist of the Franciscan Church on Merchants Quay. Professor Gillan outlines some reasons as to why classical music has not entered into the culture of certain people.
Well, I think the problem with classical music is exposure. The first music we come in contact with are the music, what we call the music of popular culture. When we turn on the radio, we hear all the time. For classical music, you have to do a little bit of searching. And a number of people miss out on this expression, or they find that the ethos in which classical music is conducted and performed is rather stuffy, and perhaps not, certainly doesn't resonate with contemporary youth. And that is because, I suppose, it's transmitted largely by an older generation who've had the benefits of being initiated into it. School education is a huge place to form, to play in this, and I suppose the more middle class schools would be able to provide this in a way that other schools can't. So that tends to give it, unfortunately, a class orientation. But I think most people, most musicians, most music educators would feel passionately in the in making music available to all and sundry. And we all know that some of the very best musicians, executants and composers have, of course, come from the lower socioeconomic groupings. The talent is spread all over the place.
Paraphrasing briefly so far, militating against the uptake of classical music is the, I suppose, daily bombardment of pop music. However, it must be said before we proceed that if there is a class divide vis-a-vis classical music, it's not coming from the musicians. Music and social class, you've just referred to it. Is there any historical development that brought about almost an evolution, or brought about the idea that music, that certain music was appreciated largely by a certain class?
Yes, I think there is a very clear historical explanation for that, given that Western classical music, first of all, it began, if you like, with the monasteries.
Thank you.
which were themselves elitist organisations, as it were. And that they developed the great chant, the great marvellous corpus of Western monodic music, melody only, which is one of the treasures of the world. And when that developed, as we moved through the late Middle Ages into the Renaissance and the Baroque, then it became the princes, the princely courts, who largely supported music and set up establishments to gratify their own interests. Succeeded in making this music somehow associated with the upper classes. And it wasn't really until Beethoven's time, when Beethoven saw this as an affront to a more ordinary sort of human being who sort of said, with the Ninth Symphony, of course, alle Menschen, alle Freude, all men are equal, as it were. And he refused to be cocooned into this aristocratic place where a musician was a servant, as it were, of the aristocracy.
I'm an ordinary man, nothing special, nothing grand. I've had to work for everything I own.
And since those days, so to speak, you'd be happy to say, to a point, or you'd be happy to state that since that, classical music has been ever opening all over the last century.
Oh yes, that is absolutely true. It is much more, of course, much more democratic now. But it is to some extent, I think, tinged by social divide in those who are involved in it. And you've only to look at the music academies throughout our country, look at the background of students, and you'll find, I'm sorry to say, predominance of middle class.
Exaggerating, tongue-in-cheek, rap is for people on the margins. Raucous, rowdy ballads are for the working class when they're tired. And then for those who are a little bit more meditative and reflective, we have the classical music.
Yeah. Well, I think people now are much more broad in their interests, particularly, I mean, I'm thinking of a number of very good classical musicians I would know who would equally turn on and put on their rap music or rock music for personal enjoyment. I think people are much more, as I said, democratic and much more broad spread in their sympathies than perhaps a couple of generations ago. And that's why I think classical musicians themselves are almost, to a man or woman, are non-elitist, but the image is still there.
There still might be a perception out there that classical music is for the upper classes. And indeed, it can also be argued that to purchase a grand piano or to purchase years of classes in classical music, one has to have a disposable income. However, we will listen to contributors later on who will challenge the assertions that money is preventing ordinary people, so to speak, from taking up classical music.
I mean, there is a question of money, but classical music does require a lot of subvention. Orchestras are extremely expensive things to run. They depend now on subvention. The subvention now tends to come in the form of state grants. Countries throughout the world now support these sort of organisations. Opera houses are again the same. They cannot exist on just purely mercenary and commercial terms. They do need subsidy. And of course that itself should bring the whole availability of these art forms to the ordinary people.
And these ordinary people, do you think in some ways, I imagine that many ordinary people are lower socio-economic category people, I imagine that they really, frankly, they don't have the time or the experience or the cultural wherewithal to think about classical music. They just... That's yeah. Not in their genes,
yes.
Almost.
Yes, I suppose particularly with a couple of generations ago, it was much common. More common, if you think, for example, take our own radio here. We just had one radio station which covered all genres of music, and that meant that everybody was exposed to all genres of music. But now, of course, we have specialized stations, and my classical arts have been marginalized, pushed back to the lyric FM, as it were, which means only about 5% of the population ever listen to that station.
So the reasons, if we can use that term, why certain classes don't listen to classical music is not necessarily that they can't afford it or that they can't access it. It may have begun in as simple a thing as the appearance of a large number of radio stations, all offering different music types. So much choice makes it difficult for the proponents of one particular genre to attract new connoisseurs, if you like. But can we convince people who have no history of classical music, can we convince them to take up classical music? Or could I say to you, who are we to tell those people?
Well, ultimately people have to make their own choices, but I do think the education system is vital here. Exposure in school years can determine the whole course of future interests. And we all know what an inspiring teacher has done for most of us. Most of us in our experience have at least one, if not or two or three, teachers who really left a very remarkable impact on our development. And a teacher who's himself or herself interested in music and tries to introduce their young charges to this can have an enormous impact. I think that's where it's very, very important.
Time and time again throughout this radio documentary, we will hear the concepts exposure and teaching. And these are two concepts which, when transferred to our public schools, need not necessarily cost a lot of money. Aptly enough, Professor Gerard Gillan ended his piece by speaking about the need to educate people, to provide music education for more and more people. I went along to Music Generation, where I spoke to Rosaline Malloy. Rosaline tells me what the aims and objectives of Music Generation are.
Rosaline Malloy, and I'm the director of Music Generation, which is Ireland's national music education programme that is funded by U2 and the Ireland Funds. And it aims to help children and young people access vocal and instrumental tuition in their locality.
Or why did somebody feel the need in the first place to set up this organisation?
Well, U2 for some time had been looking for an opportunity to be able to get involved in supporting music education in Ireland and providing access for children and young people to learn to play a musical instrument. And a number of years ago, they looked at a number of options, and one of the options that was presented to them were proposals by Music Network, which is the national agency for developing music in Ireland, funded by the Arts Council. And it proposed a music education partnership model where local agencies would come together and work together to provide coordinated services for tuition.
Was there an impression that more children needed more music, or not even needed more music, that children were not getting enough music?
Well, that there may be a perception that there's lots of music out there, but actually access to participation in music education for children and young people is really, we rate very, very lowly by international standards. And one of the most recent statistics is that it's less than 1% of secondary children have access and the choice to be able to learn to play an instrument or to use the voice. By European standards, it's about 8%. So we lag very far behind. And while Ireland has a very rich cultural and musical profile and heritage, most children receive a music education by accident rather than actually by right. So it depends on many things. It depends on where you live, if your parents are in a position to be able to afford it, if there's expertise available locally, if education and access to music education is valued, you know, by parents, by educators, by the community. So there's lots of barriers facing children and young people.
That's a telling remark by Rosaline, i.e. that many children come into contact with music by accident. And of course, one of the important fundamentals of a music education is that music education be valued. A quick question here would be, do all socioeconomic groups value music education equally or differently? Was there ever a perception, and could it have been justified, that the middle classes and upper were the ones who could only afford music classes?
No, that's not a perception. That's the reality. Because to access vocal or instrumental tuition, in most cases around the country, you have to pay for it. And when it has to be paid for, particularly in the times we're in, many parents are just not in a position to be able to afford it. It is their right as a citizen of any country, not just Ireland, that they should have equal access and equality of access to music education and indeed to the arts. Most children who are, I hate to say, in the privileged position of receiving it, do so because parents are in a position to be able to afford to pay fees. And again, this is something that Music Generation hopes to be able to address through working with these local music education partnerships around the country.
Not all of our contributors will agree with Rosaline on this, especially when it comes to the idea that money and having money is important for obtaining access to, I suppose, proper musical training. Rosaline also insists that it is a right, that music and arts, she added, is a right of all in society. And she repeats again, it does cost money. It tends to be the more privileged who can pay for good music lessons. But there will be people to point out that some people choose to spend their money on music and others choose to spend it on, for example, satellite dishes or expensive pop concerts. More on that later. I say to Rosaline Malloy, music is there for everybody. It is accessible, but it's a question of choice.
I mean, many things come down to the value and the choice, and we all can't afford everything. But I mean, what I would argue is that we have a job of work as music educators. We have a job of work to do to actually educate parents and the wider community of the value and the importance of music education. And if it always will remain a choice, well, then we will have for the future many hundreds of thousands of Irish children and young people who will never receive it. And therefore, access must be equal. It must be for everybody from birth. And when it is something that everybody does and is exposed to every day of their lives, then it doesn't become something that people choose. It becomes something that people must have.
Now, Rosaline Malloy did not say this, but if I wanted to extrapolate, if I wanted to extend on what she said, I wouldn't go as far as to say that music should be obligatory. But some way must be found, in her words and in my words, some way must be found to expose, if you like, unwilling children or children who are unaware of music. Some way must be found to expose them to music. This means, surely, that somebody has decided that music is good for you and music, everybody must be given a chance to benefit from a music education. Big government might say, yes, music is going to be an obligatory subject because we believe it's good for society at large. Whereas a more neoliberal attitude would say, well, why should the taxpayer pay to fund music education for people who don't even want it? Let he who wants music education pay for it. As in all aspects of life, nothing is clear-cut. I went along to the music department at St. Patrick's College in Drumcondra, where I met Dr. John O'Flynn. John reminds us that although classical music, for example, can be a marker of identity, many of the people who go to classical music events have a genuine passion for this type of music. John proceeds also to reject the notion of a direct link between the type of music you like and your social class.
I don't know if there's a logic, but I certainly think there's a history, and there's been quite a bit written about it. Insofar as you did, around from the second half of the 19th century onwards, you did see a pretty much an alignment of different types of music with different strata, socioeconomic strata in society. So yes, I think that some people would use what people generally call classical music as a marker of identity. So for example, to be seen to be going to the opera. That said, some people who, it's very complicated, because some people who enjoy dressing up and being seen going to the opera genuinely have a passion for opera. I know that my father would have loved opera, although he wasn't an opera goer. He would have been a man who sang the opera arias while cleaning the windows. So at the other end of the spectrum, you can say that it's not necessarily tied to social class, but there are strong reasons why it is. And I think it's there are many individuals and there are many counter tendencies. And I think that's changing anyway. it wouldn't be as strong. And of course, we should be very careful about using a term like classical music, because it covers so many different genres. And if you think about some of the more avant-garde contemporary groups and practices, such as the Crash Ensemble, groups like that would be very, actively engaged in trying to break down that type of formality that's associated with classical music, to the extent that at their gigs they would encourage people to bring the beer back into the performance.
Certain classes gravitate towards certain music more than other classes.
No, I totally disagree with that. That would be what in subcultural theory is called a homology, where you suggest that a certain group of people, whether it's ethnic or socioeconomic, have structural links. There's structural links between the music and their community. I totally would disagree with that. It does happen, though, and it doesn't happen because there is a link between the people and the music. It happens because of other circumstances. You know, in my own case, I mean, I feel privileged, but if I was to compare, if I had been born into a different type of Dublin community, I may have ended up, as you say, you know, surrounded by people who, to paraphrase you, sang loud ballads, or I could have ended up in one of the cathedral choirs, which would have almost automatically given me a fast track into choral music. And it was much later through my own activity as a postgrad student living abroad that I got into that. So people have different kind of access and exposure to music, but I really think that the individual, I suppose, capacity for music transcends social origins.
And you mentioned access there, you used the word access there. Has everybody in Ireland got equal access to music?
Clearly they don't. We have, first of all, you know, there's a couple of equity issues. One has to do with schools, and depending on where you go to school, you may have access to, in your primary school, there may be an excellent teacher who can teach music, or there may not be, or the school may have additional funds where they will bring in peripatetic teachers. But similarly in the secondary schools, with no disrespect to the very fine schools that take part, say, in the televised choir competitions, but you know, you don't have to be a sociologist to work out that they tend to be the fee-paying schools that do best. Not in every case. And, you know, so there are certain schools in Dublin, for example, that would have several choirs and orchestras, and others in other parts of Dublin or the parts of the country where they would struggle to get one ensemble together. So, yes, those are issues. And that obviously goes then to the college stage, where, you know, some people really have an expectation that they might end up in one of the conservatoires and so on because of the actual privilege. And no one is to, this is not to to be critical of those who have privilege, because it's nothing wrong with privilege. It's just that it's something denied to other people is the issue.
Yeah, but then I could say to you, yeah, but it's only music. Like, we're not talking about jobs here. We're just talking about a bit of music.
Yes, you could say it's only music, but if it's obviously important to people, and if everybody wants it, then I think it's important that we do consider what access routes people have to that.
In general, in life skills, in the rounding off of an individual, in the comprehensive development, if you like, of an individual, where does music come in priority-wise?
I can't answer that in terms of, I can't quantify it, but I would say that I'm really glad you asked this question, because I fear that we're going through a very reductionist type of phase in debate about education in Ireland, particularly when this fear that we're falling down on literacy and numeracy tables. Unfortunately, it's seen as though the time spent in the arts is in some way, I suppose, reducing. And, you know, all the evidence, particularly evidence carried out in the UK, there was a Cambridge review of basically initiatives where they decreased time given to the arts and increased in numerous initiatives. They found no difference whatsoever. So the idea that music somehow is peripheral doesn't seem to be borne out in society. It doesn't seem to be borne out in terms of what people do. And it's it's one of those areas that in terms of education, you could say that music as a subject in school, or whether you go to an instrumental or vocal lesson, it is actually one of those things that continues on right throughout your life. So it's not just important in terms of a Leaving Cert, although it's heartening to see that the participation rates for music in the Leaving Cert have really significantly risen over the last decade or so. But it's not just about the Leaving Cert, it's about your participation throughout your whole life and your engagement. And furthermore, we might say that music is not merely something, a fine art or emotional or social, but there, if you wished, you could make a very, very strong case for music as important in terms of cognitive development. And indeed, I can't cite the exact research, but I believe that many prospective employers actually regard music graduates as being very suited towards subsequent careers in technology and in communications and in business, because the actual discipline of studying music involves so many aspects of the brain.
You're listening to 103.2 Dublin City FM, and the name of this program is Music and Social Class. You've just heard a conversation with Dr. John O'Flynn from St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra. And the final part of his contribution will remind you of what we had said before. That is, how important is music? Should music be made almost obligatory? Is music as important as maths, as English? From a sociological point of view, from a social class point of view, Dr. John O'Flynn insists that music taste transcends social class. And he points out that his, if you like, working class father would sing arias while he was working at home. So one could say, more than social class, it's habit. It's what you hear in the house. And his father never went to operas, and yet he sang opera arias. It's very complex. It's very complex because on the one hand, you're almost tempted to say there is a definite link between your socioeconomic power and whether you access fine music. But at the same time, we can still find examples. We can still find examples of people who have no particularly strong socioeconomic power, and yet they do access classical music, opera and the like. So it certainly isn't black and white. But it seems to be boiling down to a question of what you're exposed to. Now, parental involvement in what children do with their free time, and indeed at school, is very important. This theme will be taken up by Joanna Crooks. Since 2006, Joanna Crooks has been managing the development of the violin and orchestra project based in St. Agnes's Primary School, Crumlin. It is worth noting here that Joanna doesn't necessarily agree that mere and simple exposure or opportunity is enough. The love of music and music training requires hard work and requires parental involvement. This is important to point out, I feel, because opportunity and exposure alone is not enough. Let's listen to Joanna Crooks.
In parental expectations are a huge factor in children's success in school. If the parents expect the children to work hard and expect the children to do well and expect the children to aim for something that's really difficult and ambitious, the children are more likely to do it. And the more children you have in a group together who are aiming for something difficult, the more likely they are to succeed, because they're supporting each other. And all parents know that, because they're always saying casually, oh, she's in with a good crowd, or she's not in with a good crowd, you know, because that's true. I mean, if there's a crowd who always want to be out on weeknights, obviously they won't study so much as the ones who are really focused and stay in and study.
I could connect what you said to private fee-paying schools, that they would go in there with an ethos of, let's work hard, you are going to fulfil your potential. Hail, rain or snow.
Yeah, and there's another factor with the fee-paying schools, which they don't say in the newspaper. The parents have invested a lot of money in it. And people invest a lot of money in something, it means a lot to them. They haven't done that lightly. And so, obviously, that's going to have a bearing. They're not going to be happy to see their child messing around if they've paid for that.
So becoming knowledgeable of music, becoming good at music or good at playing a musical instrument, very often needs time, and not just the time of a child or a practitioner, but the time, as you heard there, of the parents. And indeed, it needs money. Now, there are grants and there are subventions and subsidies, But there's no escaping the fact that apart from hard work and discipline, money and time at some stage are involved. Now therein lies food for thought for those who come at this from a sociological angle, i.e. who can afford the time, who can afford the money, who has the space perhaps in their house for a piano or a violin, who has the discipline to impose that or to give or to pass that on to their children, who has the education, the previous knowledge. So many questions can be asked, and depending on how you ask them and who you're talking to, social class is very important or social class doesn't matter at all when it comes to music. Therein lies a spectrum. Joanna Crooks argues also that money is not necessarily the problem. Why don't some people, or maybe many people, or why didn't they have a chance to play music?
It's the financial barrier. There's a huge financial barrier unless music is provided in school. And children are also disadvantaged, not just by the financial barrier, but there are some children, even if the parents could afford to buy an instrument and could afford the lessons, the parents are both working and they can't facilitate a child in an after-school activity. The children are going to after-school clubs, and it does take some dedication on the part of parents to support practicing to achieve excellence at any level.
So is it just a question of money then?
It's more a question of priorities and when the priorities begin to be established within the family and what will be spent on what. If you think of the price of roller blades and football boots, and money gets spent, but you will find with the different groups of people are making different choices.
We could call it a mixture of self-exclusion and external exclusion. And perhaps even a more telling word and a more insightful word she used was habit. Some families are just simply not in the habit of sending their kids to classes, to music classes.
And that's what social inclusion is all about. You know, that's where you come back to that. I mean, the real philosophy of the school is that every child should have the chance to explore their own creativity, and we're offering it particularly through music in this school.
And that was Joanna Crooks of the St. Agnes Project in Crumlin. Angela De Burka is a professional violinist who has performed in diverse settings as classical performance, theatre work and with rock bands. She is also a qualified music therapist. If one of the factors in encouraging music is down to what pupils are taught in schools, then surely music education must be given more priority. Normally, probably music is once a week. It's a once a week affair. If it were in your hands, it would be more.
Teacher. If it was in my hands, oh yeah. But it depends on the teacher. If I was the teacher, they'd be doing loads of music because I'm confident about it and I have an idea of how to go about it and I have a passion for it. And I think primary school teachers, they have to stick to the curriculum. They have to do a certain amount of everything, but the amount that they end up doing will be. I think it's dictated by how much they love what it is or how confident they feel or how much obligation there is to do it. Like, they have to do Irish and English and maths and religion every single day, and then history and geography less often but more often than music. I think music is really down the list.
That short contribution by professional violinist and music therapist Angela De Burka didn't specifically explore the social class aspect, but it did deal with the idea of exposure, of giving more music to young children whilst they are in school. Now, here are two characters I met on Grafton Street some time ago. Boris, a busker violinist, and James Whelan from the Liberties, who is also a composer and singer. Briefly, they just touch on the idea that if, for example, opera or classical music is or was perceived as posh or snobby or highbrow, it wasn't always the case. The curious thing is that years ago in Ireland, many so-called working class men and women joined choirs and went to the opera and went to classical music events without there being a mention of class division or social class. Let's hear now from Boris and James Whelan.
Opera used to be mainstream, most much more popular than nowadays.
And then every once a week or so there'd be a party in our house, and there'd been a few drinks up now. My mother and father didn't drink much. That time the pubs would close early on a Sunday, 7 o'clock, and a few friends out of the bar would come up, and they all sung good songs, and they all had lovely voices, some of them. Some of them were really... I could have got people that were as good as Pavarotti and all like that at those days. and Six O'Coughlin and all those, and even the famous operatic singers. I knew a girl lived 2 doors from me. She never got a lesson in music in her life, and she had a beautiful voice. What they used to do was one person would sing, and then they'd say, "You have a noble call," and they'd call on someone else, and then they'd have a noble call, and go all around, and everybody in the place would nearly sing, you know. You had to entertain yourself years ago, a lot of entertainment. There was no televisions, and very few people even had a radio at those times. People couldn't afford those things. Of course, they weren't even invented then, televisions and all like that. And they used to have battery radios. So, I mean to say, it was a lot different then, you know.
That very brief contribution by Boris and James Whelan still managed to unearth a useful concept, which is that of habit, which we already heard previously when speaking to Joanna Crooks. People in the 50s and 40s and 60s seemed to be in the habit of getting together and in the habit of singing classical songs, or, as James Whelan called them, old songs. That habit now seems to have been largely lost. But it wasn't a habit that was confined to one class. It seemed to be across all classes. Lonard Murphy is the director of the Palestrina Choir at the Pro Cathedral. Lonard first developed an interest in organ music when she was about 10 years of age. She has been the director of the Palestrina Choir since 2002. We've just spoken to James Whelan and Boris about the non-class, if you like, aspect of classical music. Lonard Murphy will also talk about the social backgrounds of a typical pupil of the choir.
Well, we have actually a very big outreach programme to the inner city kids here. We have a very strong connection with school across the road. We've 4 or 5 boys and 3 coming through in the training class right from the heart of Dublin. And it's unbelievable. You see a kid who's literally from around the corner, then best friends with a boy and his little cricket whites, and it's kind of a very unusual mix. And I think also the fact we go into schools, sometimes parents didn't even know that their child was musical, so it's sort of suddenly not something they've necessarily sought after, but then they've realised the benefits and they've gone with it. So we have a very interesting supportive group, but I don't think in that normal pushy way that might be associated with the type of activity like this. And the social balance is, I must say, it's very, very varied.
There's yet another aspect of music and social class I hadn't thought about, and that is, paraphrasing the words of Lonard Murphy, some parents, maybe many parents, don't even know that their child has a musical talent. The question here could be, well, which parents do know? Which parents make it their business to know if their child has a music talent? And in general, if you and I were to go to an opera tonight, do you think that most of the people would be of a certain class in general?
Yes, I think they would. And I think from a boy being in this choir, they're able to experience something they possibly never would have ordinarily. We have one of our local kids who we were singing one of the Matthew Passion, and I saw him walking down Marlborough Street with his Matthew Passion tucked under his arm. I mean, this was such a kind of extraordinary sort of juxtaposition. Contact. Yeah.
And that was Lonard Murphy, director of the Palestrina Choir, on the social mix of her students and on the reality that her inner city pupils do go on to appreciate classical music. Whereas we have to assume if they hadn't been touched by the Palestrina Choir, they possibly would never have gone near classical music or church singing.
And perhaps that's a huge part of music training, music appreciation, and that is that every child should be given the chance. Now, of course, some would go further than waiting for the chance to be given to them. And these are the parents who actually seek the chance, who seek the opportunity for music.
In an attempt to tie the preceding contributions together, I travelled out to the University of Maynooth, where I met the sociologist, Dr. Colin Coulter. Dr. Colin Coulter, as a sociologist, also specialises in popular culture. And his contribution will take us almost to the end of this programme, which is called Music and Social Class. Dr. Coulter will take a much more cynical view of why certain people gravitate towards classical music. And in a way, he solves the problem, if you like, of how people who have money still opt not to spend it on classical music and opt for other things. I began the conversation with Dr. Colin Coulter by reading from an article on social capital. The goods and resources that are referred to here are defined by a man called Bourdieu as capital. Capital is the term used for assets which an individual has at their disposal to use in their competitive field. There are several forms of capital: economic, social, symbolic, and most relevant to my question today, cultural capital. Cultural capital represents the dispositions one has through socialization, for example, one's beliefs and opinions towards music genres. It is also the factor which influences consumption of cultural goods. Do you have any understanding of social capital or cultural capital? What would that mean for you, Colin?
Well, I mean, it's a very famous idea in sociology. As you say, they're associated with Pierre Bourdieu. And the idea is that in societies that are organized around hierarchies of class, that these distinctions are expressed and reproduced through material distinctions of wealth and poverty, but also are articulated and reproduced through cultural hierarchies, distinctions of taste, that the more materially affluent parts of elements of society will also express their dominant position through certain forms of cultural appropriation, cultural taste, the things that they like, the things that they don't like, the force fields that are thrown up around certain forms of cultural expression that exclude perhaps less advantaged people, exclude them sometimes because they can't afford access. But I think perhaps even more more critically and more frequently than that, these are force fields of cultural taste. People quite often have a sense that these are not things that are for the likes of them. They don't perhaps have the cultural self-confidence to engage in these forms of cultural expression. So it's certainly a very recurrent motif in a lot of sociological thought, that these distinctions of class are not merely material. They're cultural as well, around tastes, around things like food and clothes and what we're talking about here today, music.
Are you saying that consciously people who love classical music would regard classical music not just as good music, but they would also regard it as an external sign of what? Of status, of knowledge, of education? Or can it not just be they like classical music and they happen to be relatively powerful in society? Let's not read too much into that.
Well, I think it can be all of the above. I'm sure a great many people have a genuine and long-standing passion for example, classical music. What you'll often find is that those people come from backgrounds where classical music was cherished, was regarded as important, was loved, or perhaps more cynically at times regarded as something which people of a certain standing simply have to have as part of their kind of cultural repertoire. So people can certainly like classical music and genuinely like classical music, but it's also part of a kind of a cultural sense of self, of certain elements of society. And quite often, you know, particularly one of the most obvious expressions of this, the forcing of young children to have piano lessons and violin lessons, which quite often they'll thank their parents for when they're much older. But it is certainly the acquisition of a certain amount of cultural capital, an arming of oneself culturally, which I think most people who don't grow up in those parts of a city like Dublin will recognise as being other, as being alien, as being very, very far away from their own sense of who they are.
And yet I'm sure I have heard people, classical musicians and classical music teachers, saying that they would oblige their children to play classical instruments because they believe it gives them discipline, it gives them a sense of order in the mind. They have it quite clear that it's not just about status, it's actually about almost improving the mind of the child almost.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's true. Very, very few people set out deliberately to discriminate, very few people will admit to doing so. It's not as though there are, you know, darkened rooms in certain parts of Dublin 4 where people get together to map out what culturally they're going to be and what culturally other people will not be allowed to be. But certainly a genuine sense of an appreciation of classical music doesn't necessarily not go along with the reproduction of a certain social class in society, the marking of boundaries, the articulation of a sense of, well, we're... I mean, if you take, for example, at the level of universities. Historically, until certainly 20, 30 years ago, it was very unusual to see popular music taught in university. It's only quite recently that people will talk about popular music. But obviously, the canon of classical music has been part of the university curriculum for several generations. And in Ireland, certainly in the Republic of Ireland, I mean, that's still the case. It's still very, very unusual for people to study popular music at university level, whereas it would be very unusual for any university here to have a music department which essentially reproduced the canon. It's very obvious in, you know, even in the funding of, for example, of doctoral research, that money will be provided to students who are studying classical music, to students who are studying traditional Irish music. But it is, I think, really almost unheard of for students studying popular music to be funded at doctoral level in this society. That gives you a sense of what is privileged, a sense of what is important, a sense of what is valued. It's a very, very old understanding of what cultural knowledge is and what cultural knowledge should be. In fact, it's a 19th century one. It's at least two centuries out of date.
Serious music, it has been said, was enjoyed by the bourgeoisie, whilst popular music was enjoyed by the masses. Serious music, to the bourgeoisie, was a form of art, and hence had to be preserved from becoming a meaningless form of entertainment. Schoenberg demonstrated this when he stated, "If it is art, then it is not for all. And if it is for all, then it is not art."
Says who? You know, who gets to decide these things? And certainly historically, there is a long tradition, and it's a very complex and complicated tradition in the study of popular music, probably associated most closely with Theodor Adorno, who was a student of Schoenberg's. And the perspective associated with Adorno, certainly the simplified version of it, is that essentially popular music is emblematic of the, I suppose, the cultural emptiness of capitalist society, that it is a place where people go to play because they find no other form of enjoyment in their working lives. And while I would be very sympathetic to the critique of capitalist society offered by Adorno, I don't share his revulsion at popular culture, and his revulsion was widespread. It was television, it was cinema, it was perhaps most famously popular music.
Here is a statement. Wilensky criticised Bourdieu for inferring high status implies snobbery and an aversion to popular culture, as he found that nearly all highly educated people in the United States regularly enjoyed forms of popular culture and not just highbrow culture. Now here's the interesting part. This is similar to the findings of Lamont, who argued that highly educated people in the US have cultural sophistication but also include mainstream culture. However, in Europe, there is a preference to remain culturally exclusive. Is it fair to ask you to link this in? So forgetting about America, however, in Europe, music seems to be a little bit more exclusive or excluding. Could that tie in with your anecdote about the Swedish House Mafia and Leonard Cohen? Would you like to just retell that?
Well, I think, you see, that class is so... There was, certainly back in the 1990s, there was a lot of... orthodoxy in a lot of social science was that class was old hat, it was an old-fashioned idea and it no longer existed. I mean, there was a very famous book at the time called The Death of Class. And if you look at popular music, certainly class boundaries have become a little bit more porous, they become more complicated. But in the realm of popular music, you can see just how important class remains. I mean, if you look at, say, for example, the coverage of the Swedish House Mafia gig, which I wasn't even in the country at the time when it happened, but reading stuff online, there was, now, obviously, things happened there that should not have happened, and there were instances of violence which are, you know, obviously unpleasant and so on. But, I mean, certainly at the time, I remember reading reports that made very little attempt to disguise their contempt for that particular genre of music, the kinds of people who like that genre of music. And the incidents of violence were used as a pretty convenient opportunity to express what was, I think, in some instances, a real form of snobbery and a real form of contempt for the masses as such. Whereas if you see, for example, you know, the coverage of Leonard Cohen, the gigs he's played here, the very expensive gigs that he's played here. And I went to one just around the corner here in the grounds of what was Kilmainham Hospital, now Emma. And if you want to see what class is, you only had to be at that gig. You only had to see the 4x4s pulling up here in Inchicore and Kilmainham. You only had to experience the fact that of all the gigs I've gone to, the hundreds of gigs I've gone to, it was the only one of which I wasn't searched and nobody was searched. And speaking to somebody who was working at the gig subsequently, that person did suggest that this was a deliberate policy because the people working there were informed that this was a different class of person who wouldn't like being searched, and there was no need to because they were, you know, they were of good stock. And I remember there was a champagne bar, there was, you know, very expensive entertainment outlets on there, food and drink outlets, and it was a whole different composition. And reflected in the, you know, the coverage, promotion in advance of the gig, the coverage of it. A clear fact that quite obviously Leonard Cohen as an artist chimed with the tastes of great many journalists, etc., etc. I mean, you're talking about two different events, one of which there was violence and one of which there wasn't. So, of course, there's going to be different representations of the events. But class was quite clearly at play in both of these events and how they were organised, how they were experienced, how they were represented. And it's just yet another indication that class is alive and well and kicking certain people, you know. This is a class society.
And yet, class is alive and well, and yet, according to an article I have read, a major new theory into the field of social class and music taste is that of the omnivore. This term was introduced by a man called Peterson. This argument suggests that educated middle classes are moving away from Bourdieu's snobbish high culture and becoming cultural omnivores. That is, where they embrace a variety of high, middle and lowbrow tastes. It has become an important argument as it resonates with claims about postmodernism and a death of status and cultural capital. And what's more, Peterson and Simkus also found that people from higher status groups tend to appreciate more musical genres than lower status groups. Their music taste structure is completely different to that created by Bourdieu, as their study demonstrates a reverse pyramid. So, chapeau to the middle classes or the educated classes. They are opening up, becoming more liberal. They are perhaps not saying it, but I can say it for them. We enjoy our classical music, but we also enjoy a huge range of other music. Whereas you people in the lower status groups, you seem to be stuck in the groove.
I think there's an element of truth in it, and the element of truth is, I think certainly, something I mentioned earlier, I think particularly the existence of digital technologies has allowed a lot of people to broaden their cultural tastes. And I think this is very obvious. It's obvious across musical genres, and it's obvious across time. I think young people have remarkable knowledge of popular music that predates their birth. I think so. There is certainly an element of the omnivorous. But I think that at the same time, I think there are still quite clear patterns in terms of the association of social class and certain versions of popular music. I mean, if you take, for example, something like hip-hop, you know, whose origins obviously are in urban African-American poor communities, the reason why it's the most popular genre of popular music in the history of popular music is because it skipped the boundaries into suburban, white, middle-class households. So certainly these boundaries, as I said before, become more porous. But they remain patterned in very particular ways, and I think there are force fields around classical music, regardless of the intentions of people who love classical music. It is something that people feel themselves excluded from, people aren't familiar with, people are perhaps... I mean, an environment like the National Concert Hall is, if you're not used to that environment, and personally I'm not used to that environment, is intimidating. It is quite intimidating for people. But to suggest that, you know, class no longer matters in these things is part of a political agenda that's been around for a very long time that actually doesn't really make any sense in the real world. There's so many examples of it you could give, but I mean, just even thinking, talking earlier about, you know, what happened at the Barbra Streisand concert out in Castletown, out in Selbridge. And if I remember rightly, there were a lot of people there, you know, from, you know, the upper echelons of the Dublin professional classes, and their grievances of what happened became a national news story. I think a lot of them were reimbursed very quickly. I don't think a lot of young working class Dublin girls at a Beyoncé gig in some similar circumstances would ever have a chance of being reimbursed in the same way. I mean, class is always, it is always there. The boundaries have become a little bit more blurred. I think that's that is definitely true. I don't think there is the same taboo around mixing of musical genres as there was, say, for example, even as recently as the 1980s or the 1990s. But I mean, class certainly casts a very long shadow over what people choose to choose, what people are allowed to choose, what people are not allowed to choose, those things that exist in people's lives and those things that exist somewhere in the middle distance, beyond people's reach. Not necessarily economically, because classical gigs are usually much less expensive than pop gigs, but culturally, in terms of how people understand themselves and what they're entitled to like.
I hope I'm not being lazy when I say that there might be just one concept, one word to summarise the preceding programme, and that word is culture. And we could add a second word, capital. It all comes down to cultural capital. That sounds like a rather black and white description of so many complex aspects, but it might be able to englobe all of those aspects. Here is possibly the best conclusion to be made of this programme, Music and Social Class, and it comes from the mouth of a parent involved in the St. Agnes Project Orchestra.
It should represent everybody. It shouldn't just represent this part of society because they're richer and this part of society because I've always maintained, and you're talking about professionals. A doctor, for instance. I mean, okay, he's extremely intelligent in his field, right? A musician is intelligent in his field. The mechanic is intelligent in his field. So we all have intelligence. So therefore, nobody should feel left out of that circle. We all have an intelligence. We might not all use it, but we all have it.
And there ends Music and Social Class, which is part 3 of the 4-part series entitled Music is Good for You. This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland. This is 103.2 Dublin City FM.